wafting across the pastoral vistas of the new basement studios by the lake, this is the Atlantic Voice Podcast, 3,000 miles of opinion.
This is Atlantic Voice Podcast. I'm Zeph.
And I'm Eric.
Down in the new basement studios by the lake, at least my partner is, I am in our new basement, our new attic floor by the river, whatever that is. We were supposed to record last week, and then your computer went doolally at the moment of takeoff.
Plugged things in, and screen started flashing on and off, and I think I figured out afterwards that it was doing a deep update, including like its BIOS, which is like the basics of the operating piece, and including some video drivers. And I couldn't tell it was doing that until I got off, and then it was underway for like 2 hours of updates on the computer. And because I hadn't used it for a while, I think when I turned it on to do our things, it started kicking into gear, and I couldn't interrupt the process, and I wasn't sure what was going on.
I have a question. Are you the sort of person that when that occurs, it's like almost traumatic? Like, oh my gosh, my computer's gone funky. Because it is for me. Because I don't know how to get out of these things. I just stop panicking
because
we were doing this stuff.
I'm pretty familiar with updates. Otherwise, it's only because we were doing things and I couldn't tell it was doing these updates. But like normal, it's kind of exciting getting an update. Like, ooh, it's, you know, when you get an update on the software on your phone, is it going to be a new version? You know, what new features does it have? What new graphics? And then, you know, your regular computer doesn't have all those kind of updates. You know, it's not as exciting, but, you know, maybe it'll work a little better or something will be a little faster. And at one point we had a problem. We were doing a podcast, we were recording something, and I couldn't get the audio out of the headphone jack into the soundboard. And to be honest, I've never revisited to see if that works or not. But anyway, so that hopefully there's various things just change on your computer all the time. You have no idea what's going on. We just ordered another computer moments ago for business purposes for the other member of the household, since there's other like business activities. And this way, when the other member of the household is traveling abroad, does it not need to take our household laptop to do work projects, you know, other places. So
you're excited. You're excited by updates.
Yeah. It should be a good thing. It's generally not, like, it's pretty rare that nowadays, it used to be you might get an update in your phone or computer couldn't handle it, but nowadays they'd rather get you to buy a new thing, so they're not even going to offer you the opportunity to update to something that won't work.
That's what I feel is going to happen, because I have all old technology.
Yeah,
my computer's the youngest.
Nowadays, I don't think they let you. I have a couple of old Android phones, and I was trying to figure out how to repurpose one as just a internet surfing type of thing. And like it could bear, like we're up to Android 12 or something like that now. And all this one is like it can't go past 5. You know,
okay.
Like I tried to do things. Oh, it was a tablet. Somebody had an old tablet. They handed down, and I was like, oh, this could be useful for just surfing the internet when you're sitting there watching TV. And it's like, it is fine for that purpose, but it's way, way, way behind, and it's not even offering you the opportunity to update.
You did send a story that we're not going to get into depth, but this neatly segues onto this. Didn't you come across a TV that uses power from
remotes?
Yeah.
I think Samsung is trying to devise a remote that will be powered by radio waves. And people who, you know, I don't know how much you have you ever followed this stuff about Tesla versus meaning not the old Tesla guy who is like a rival to, I'm forgetting the other electricity guy, Thomas Edison, I
okay.
guess.
Yeah. Way back in time.
Yeah. So like they had rivals.
Tesla.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is his name. Yeah.
And they had rivalries about how electricity should be rolled out to the masses. And their ultimate difference ended up being about using high voltage versus high amperage and safety and things like that. But Tesla had a big idea of putting electricity, moving electricity around through radio waves.
Okay.
And you think about, like, how could that possibly be? And it's kind of, I think, it's kind of like, you know, now you have these phone induction things where you can just put your phone on a charger and it charges.
Right.
It's because it's swirling a current around a set of wires in one device, and it just swirls them around in your other device, and you never have to plug the two things in together.
That's right.
Well, that there's a version that I'm sure that's not the same as what goes on with this radio waves, but you can project through the radio waves. You can cause that kind of current in another device and get a charge. So the idea with this remote is that you would, just because it's around your computer, your TV, the TV would always be charging it via radio waves. In fact, yeah. I think it said basically it could charge itself off of almost ambient, just the radio waves that are in the world.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
There's so much stuff going around that, you know, there's essentially power being used out in the world, and it could charge it. And then they're like, oh, you know, and also maybe kind of like those watches that wind themselves by moving around, which is mechanical, but they're like an electronic version of that, where like by moving your remote around and a little weight would move over here and it's generating just a little bit of electricity, and so you'd never really have to charge this stuff or replace batteries or do those things. And as I think about it, you know, that's the kind of thing we don't think about, but I bet you that's like, you know, 20 years from now we'll sort of chuckle at the idea you had to slap in a like a AA battery to electronics, because electronics don't use as much electricity. I mean, you'd have to put it into something with light or other things like that, I think, but like a lot of electronic devices that are that basic, a remote, I mean, it doesn't draw a lot of electricity, ought to be able to run itself off of what's out there in the world.
It is amazing.
The solar too, like they're like basically like just having your lights on. Like think about those calculators, right? You have the calculators that have a little solar panel on them. You don't have to do anything other than have it in a lighted room.
Yes.
You know, so why wouldn't we end up heading there somewhere so we don't have to deal with so many batteries?
My desk calculator at my place of work has got to be nearly 20 years old, and it's a solar calculator. And
exactly.
Every time I turn it on to use it, I'm amazed that it works. Like, it feels still to me like, ooh, that is technology ahead of its time. And to be fair, talking of TV remotes, I am one of those people. Remember, I have a slightly different relationship with technology than you do. You're excited by technology. I always feel at some moment someone's trying to jam me up somehow, which is why I'm leery of updates. I have on my local cable provider, I have a remote, and the TV, the cable provider will signal to you when your battery needs to be replaced in your remote. And it's just like a AAA battery. I always ignore that warning, and I'm going to run the battery down until I'm sitting there and I can't change the channel.
Like, it's not like driving a car where you're going to be stranded somewhere. You know, you could just go up and get up a battery when you get desperate.
But it's only because I feel like they're in league with someone to make me buy batteries. So I'm like, no, I don't want your warning that it's running down. I'll know when it runs down. It's when I'm stuck watching Nickelodeon. That, do you know what I mean?
It's like the printer ink or toner in your printer, where they're like, oh, you got to get some new stuff. And you're like, there are pages coming out that are perfectly fine.
Yes.
And then you can go on the internet and like we have a small like laser printer here, and there's like a code, and it's publicly available that like, okay, if it tells you don't do anymore, you press this button, this button, this button, this button, and it'll keep going. You know, until eventually, like, there actually isn't stuff on the page, at which point I go, okay, fine.
That's when you need to change it, when there's nothing on the page. I don't trust them. I'm sorry. I don't trust them.
It's like four times I take it out and you shake it up.
Yes,
you know, it works a little better for longer, and then you do it again, you know, you get 50 more pages, and then you shake it up again, you get 50 more pages, and eventually it's all done.
And I think you know me because, I mean, I'm a bit of a minge bag. But obviously that is partly my motivation for trying to get last drop out. But also to your point, I feel
you don't
like
want to be taken.
Yeah. And that's, I feel like someone somewhere is taking me, even though,
you know, apparently, with all the supply chain issues, I guess printers are, like they're having a hard time getting their ink in, and so they've been more lenient. I was just reading some article. I forget what the deal was.
Oh, they've changed the code.
Well, like they were giving you more of a break of like how you can get more ink out of the thing, because they're like, they literally, they can't keep in cyan or magenta or whatever it is. Is it cyan or cyan? C-Y-A-N is always one of the colors in the.
Okay.
I don't know why they're not just red, green, and blue, but, you know, cyan, magenta, and yellow, and this, that, and the other thing.
So anyway,
as usual, completely distracted from our central point.
Yeah, sorry. So all right. So let's get on with the show. We've got a mishmash of, we are revisiting some long time points of interest.
Yeah.
And we also have some dead people a bit later.
Yeah, which is also like a long term interest.
Long term interest. Yes.
Now.
The first story, I don't know if anyone knew this, and this didn't get as much play as I kind of feel it should have got, that actually on the night we were originally supposed to record this show, apparently Earth had a narrow escape with an asteroid that was a kilometer wide. It was more than twice the height of the Empire State Building. So if you can visualize that, that was a pretty big asteroid. Apparently, it is the closest. It is the largest object. It is the combination of largest and closest object to sort of go by Earth. So it was a big one. And it came and it flew by. And it said it will. That apparently, it's going to come back in July later this year. But because of its orbit, it will be further away. It came within less than 700,000 miles of the planet.
Yeah,
which I know sounds like a lot, but it's not a lot.
Look up and figure out because
how wide is Earth?
Exactly.
Can you Google that?
That's what I meant.
Earth's width. Why don't you Google that? Well, I will say. Well, there are a couple of quotes. There are more than a million known asteroids that our scientists have identified, and it is not uncommon for many to fly by Earth, with the overwhelming majority being of little concern. Then again, according to Nancy Chabot, the chief planetary scientist at Johns Hopkins, there are about 25,000 near-Earth asteroids that are at least 500 feet wide that could be devastating if they crash into Earth. Now, just that's 500 feet wide, so that's about the length of about a football field and a half, right? Whatever your version of football, about a football field and a half. This one that came by the other week was a kilometer, twice the size, twice the width of the Empire State Building. But then according to these guys, quote, this couldn't have been a global extinction event, but regional devastation on an area that could wipe out a city or even a small state. Now, I don't know about you. I've seen enough movies that if it's wiping out like a city or a state, that's affecting everyone. I can't imagine that one that could wipe out a state.
Even just is economically and, you know, ultimate collateral consequences. The Earth is just under 8,000 miles in diameter, which is not, you know, so like you're talking about something that's 100 times away from that. I was trying to see.
How many miles in diameter? 8,000, you said?
Just under 7,917 and a half.
That's interesting. I always think of that makes sense, but I always think
because it's the diameter.
Yeah,
The going around.
Yes,
the outside,
not the circumference.
Take a much more distance. So, but you know, when you think about how wide it is, but
well, NASA is working on a solution. Last November, the agency launched a probe that will crash head on into a small asteroid later this year as part of a test to see if it's possible to push a future asteroid off course, as it appears as though it's going to have a catastrophic collision with the planet. It's called the Double Asteroid Redirection Test, or DART. That's what they call it, DART.
Oh, that's why they had to, like, strain themselves on
And they're going to crash it into a 500-foot-wide asteroid that has the name Dimorphos. I don't know what that means in Greek, but something not good, at 15,000 miles per hour to see if it can knock it off its orbit and not crash into Earth.
Isn't Morphous like types or shape or something
But this is Dimorphous.
Does that mean like shapeless Dimorphous? Maybe it's good they're going to hit it. Dimorphous.
It's D-I. It's D-I.
Well, because it's a double. Like, isn't it the thing called double asteroid redirection? So Dimorphos is probably meaning it's sort of like two asteroids put together.
Oh, okay.
Because dimorphism is...
having two heads.
Occurring in or respecting two distinct forms.
Oh, okay.
I should say that's dimorphic. Dimorphism, just the noun.
Yeah. So anyway, and this was, of course, this has all happened around the same time as Netflix released its movie about what would happen if asteroid came to Earth.
And part of the benefit of delaying our podcast was I was exhorting you, although I think maybe you had heard it or watched it before, got there to watch Don't Look Up, which was this sort of dark satiric comedy about the world when I think it's a comet in that case, not a asteroid. The astronomer Jennifer Lawrence, under the guidance of Leo DiCaprio as like the head of some astronomy office or something like that, finds a comet that's headed towards Earth, like right towards Earth, and it's going to hit Earth. And so they try to raise alarms for people, and Yeah, the politicians and the media.
I actually have the
a trailer.
The trailer loaded up. I'm having a few technological issues of my own.
Well, while you're working on that, I will mention who's in it because it is really like a star-studded cast here. We've got, like I said, Leo DiCaprio, Jennifer Lawrence, Meryl Streep, Jonah Hill, Cate Blanchett, Tyler Perry, Ron Perlman, Timothy Chalamet. I mean, that guy's all over the place.
Yes,
you know. Mark Rylance, who people would recognize.
Mike Rylance, big Steven Spielberg.
Mark Rylance,
big. I think he won an Oscar.
Or Mark Rylance.
Yeah, he won an Oscar for something with Spielberg. Anyway, I now have the trailer ready.
There you go. Gina Gershon.
All right.
This is not real. This is not real. This is not real. This isn't happening. Kate, tell me this isn't really happening.
I hear there's something you don't like the looks of.
We discovered a very large comet.
Oh, good for you. It's headed directly towards Earth.
This comet is what we call a planet killer.
At this exact moment, I say we sit tight and assess.
Sit tight and assess?
Sit tight.
And then assess. The sit tight part comes first, then you gotta digest it. That's the assessment period.
This is the worst news in the history of humanity. He just blew us off.
What are we gonna do? We have to release the information.
So we just leak it.
Our guests today have made a pretty big discovery in space.
How big is this thing going? I can't destroy my ex-wife's house. Is that possible?
There's a 100% chance that we're all going to die. Well, the handsome astronomer can come back anytime, but the yelling lady, not so much.
All right, so you heard all the people that my partner listed. That was the trailer for the Netflix movie Don't Look Up. It's sort of a... I mean, it is a satire. And obviously, asteroids attacking Earth or comets or whatever crashing into Earth has been done to death at a serious level. All the way back, we've talked about the 70s movie Meteor with Sean Connery, who plays a... Is he the Russian? No, he's American. Whatever. Then obviously, we talked at length about... God, what was the one?
Armageddon, Deep Impact.
And Armageddon. But so this one is sort of, while, you know, this one has an aspect of those movies in it where, you know, there's a little bit about a mission to save the Earth. This is really about a couple of scientists who discover this thing, and then no one at the White House takes them seriously because it's not good
media. Nobody in the world, basically. Right. And then we've got an Elon Musk's type character.
Yes.
Ezo type character is Mark Rylance.
Mark Rylance.
The one who plays him. The one who plays him, where it's like suddenly it turns into this, oh, I've got a wonderful tech solution and I've got, you know, some sort of autism, but that's good because it's going to help the world out. And of course, like everything that's developed by these folks, that it doesn't work out as well as they plan, because otherwise, what would be the point of the movie? Written and directed by Adam McKay, who Adam McKay is like the main, well, for years, they've had a falling out in recent years. With Will Ferrell.
Had a falling out over an LA Lakers documentary, apparently.
That's right.
That's what I'm hearing. Yes.
Yeah. So, but I mean, back in the day, he did like Anchorman, Talladega Nights, like Step Brothers, like goofy comedies. Yeah. And he's been honing his craft. He
also did The Big Short,
more
though.
More close. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's gotten over years, he's gotten closer to real life with a comedic bent, obviously. And he and Will Ferrell are behind Succession, although Will Ferrell is like has no role at all with it. But they're the executive producers. He's listed as executive producer, but that's because they set it all up when they were still getting along with each other. And
yeah, because originally they had a slightly different...
One of those things where you get a credit for being the executive producer forever, even if you're not actually doing anything.
My understanding of Succession was they'd originally tried to create a movie more clearly about the Murdochs, and then it sort of got stuck in transition, and some people in HBO said, well, why don't we fictionalize it and let it go off in its own way? But obviously, because it was like an original treatment they had bandied around, they forever get, you know, they get their credit because it's their idea. Yeah. But obviously Succession, written by a very different set of people altogether. But yes, I mean, they're involved in all sorts of things. I guess I need to ask you the most tritest of questions. You obviously liked the movie, right?
Yeah, it got panned by Rotten Tomatoes 53. Yes. I thought it was good. I figured it was not going to be totally in your wheelhouse, and you know, I'm building it up so you can then, you know, do whatever you're going to do with it.
Okay.
But it is not dissimilar from those In the Loop and the other sort of British oriented dark comedies about politics and the satirical kind of stuff, Vice and those things.
I was about to say,
Vice President.
Funnily enough, not Vice.
Vice was another movie he did, but
in the Loop actually is the people in Succession were involved in that movie as well. I watched it, I felt it was a bit uneven, but it did remind me very much to your point there of like these sort of. I kept feeling style, you know, with the comedy, which was quite broad. And what I mean by that is there were a lot of pretty obvious gags, but then there was also some stuff that was very clever that you might miss. It did feel like this weird sort of, and you just mentioned it, like I kept sitting there thinking of there were movies from the 60s that were sort of like this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm thinking of people like, you know, like there was like a James Coburn movie where he plays like the president's psychiatrist or something, and this and just all these sort of 60s and movies, and stylistically it felt that way with a big cast, and you know, a lot of sort of like freeze frames and, you know, different.
Yeah, it did have some weird like graphical like elements in the way they edited it.
Yeah, it felt like something out of like 1969 or the early 70s with a slight sort of like, I don't know, like a hippie take on the establishment type thing. That's what, you know, I'm not going to see it. Like I said, I felt it was slightly more uneven, but it has a terrific cast. And it's interesting. My original comment when I was watching it was, and I don't mean this in any which way, I'm not a huge Jennifer Lawrence fan.
Mm-hmm.
And yet when I watch this, I'm like, and she's playing clearly a character, you know, a decade younger than herself. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, you know, she's got a nose ring and she's very academic and she's supposed to be this graduate astronomy type student. And I'm like, oh, wow, Jennifer Lawrence was really good in it. So it was interesting. I really enjoyed that sort of aspect of it. And you're right. It had a massive cast and quite a few of them. Mark Rylance, Cate Blanchett. I had to stop and think, oh, my God, that must be Cate Blanchett.
Yeah.
You know, Jonah Hill was clearly Jonah Hill.
She plays like a...
TV.
I was not going to say it's a Fox. It's a TV personality, newsy, but like really like
entertainment news.
Entertainment. Her and Tyler Perry play like sort of like morning show type folks. I mean, the fact that these people like they make their big announcement on what's essentially like a Today Show type
magazine show. Yeah,
don't really make a lot of sense. But she was pretty good in that stuff. I haven't fully thought this through. But I think, you know, we've talked lots about where movies have gone and the primacy of blockbusters.
Right.
It's as if there are two currents of reviews of movies now, because like it strikes me like when I watch this movie, I go, it got a 50, right? Like that's a pretty bad set of reviews on Rotten Tomatoes. And yet like a Marvel movie, you'll get like a 70 or 80 or something like that. Well, this is like. It's like they're two different products.
I want to speak to that, though.
Interesting, funny type of movies or dramas or things like that are totally separate from the blockbuster. And it's like the reviewers have decided it's a different scale of.
I have a theory.
Like, which is actually a better artistic achievement.
I have a theory about that. And because I'm this way.
You're the way that has theories about things.
Yes. But I also buy into this. I am a proponent of this theory if we were talking about something else. But I'm now going to attribute my theory to other people, but I'm going to assign them blame. Whereas I'm not going to take the blame for having this theory because I'm just a punter.
Yeah.
I think there is some inbuilt snobbery to how something is delivered. And movie stars in a movie on Netflix, I think there's a little bit of snobbery because critics conveniently rename it as TV. And I do this as well. There's a lot of rubbish on so many streaming channels. And I laugh and I go, yeah, these series are no good because HBO turned them down. Or someone more strange.
Oh.
That's what I'm saying. And I think, because I think this way as a person, I think that the reviewers sit there and see this high-profile cast. And if this was coming out in the cinema, I think they'd be slightly more generous. But because it's on Netflix, you immediately go, oh, it's just TV. Even though there are legit reasons in this day and age for things being released simultaneously, and I think that is the way things are going to go in the future, I still think amongst critics, there's a little bit of inbuilt snobbery against the product. Do you know what I mean? Like, no one has said...
Well, and this maybe this connects into that. Like, so I was thinking of this movie, and...
I'm not way about TV shows.
I'm going to get my Anderson directors wrong. Which one's the one who does the all the... you know, Life of
Wes Anderson.
Wes, he's the goofy stuff with the, and he did the stop action. So, I have nothing against him, and yet every movie he puts out will get just glowing reviews. Oh, it's so interesting.
Yeah, from people like me,
things like that. And I'm like, why isn't this at least as good as that? I mean, like, how could you, you know, if you're evaluating, but it's, I almost think it's a snobbery, and maybe it's, that's why I'm saying maybe it's related. It's like you're reviewing it on that track.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
And if it's not totally off the end, they want it to be to the point where it's inaccessible to anything other than 5% of the population.
Right.
Whereas this one is probably accessible to 20% of the population or 30% of the population. But so it's not far enough off to that edge. And it's also not over in the goofy Armageddon blockbuster thing where you could say, oh, this was a fun-filled romp or something like that, you know. And so it ends up getting this sort of weird review. Anyway, I recommend it to people. But a couple of facts there. Tying it back into our asteroids, though. The asteroid in that, I looked it up while we were going here, it was... that asteroid was supposed to be 3 to 6 miles wide. So it was legitimately a planet killer. Like, so it was going to land, and they're like, no, everybody's going to die.
That's my point. The one that actually passed us isn't a great deal smaller than that. It's over a kilometer wide. That's nearly a mile in decimal. So, I mean, what I'm saying is, that's big.
Isn't it like less than a half a mile?
No, it's like 0.75 of a mile.
Oh, yeah, right. Yes,
or 0.62 of a mile.
Yeah, yeah.
But still, it's something of a mile. And once you start getting to that size, this notion of, oh, yeah, it's just going to take out a town. No, it's going to do a lot more damage than that.
Yeah.
And that's what upset me about the real asteroid, was all these spokesmen trying to play it off like, yeah, you know, might do a little bit of damage. No, that's a planet killer.
You know, the other thing that came up around, I don't know if you saw any of this, but there was like a typical cycle of, you know, Twitter and column commentary about how this was an allegory for the environment and how we're unable to do anything about it because the systems, the politicians, the media and stuff are unable to do it. And then a bunch of people critiquing that it was not an appropriate analogy for the environment. Of course, it's, you know, like, in the environment, the argument is we're doing it ourselves, and comets, you know, from something else. And then a bunch of people on Twitter who are like, no, I watched the movie. It's about a comet.
It was
just this stupid cycle.
But I think that's also the nature of most sort of... this is the nature of the product, though. And I mean this now from a creative sense. When you watch a TV episode, when you watch a TV series that's satire... Because TV series episodes tend to be half an hour, it can get quite narrow. And so the whole episode makes sense within itself. I think with a movie, I mean, one of my biggest issues with one of the reasons I think Don't Look Up was slightly uneven was because it had so many targets. It's making fun of,
that's true.
You know, is this a disaster movie? Is it saying something about politics? Is it saying something about the environment?
Is it about COVID, you know? Is it
and I think sometimes, you know, the biggest struggle with any widescreen comedy is, you know, comedies are quite hard to pull off once you get past 90 minutes because there's a sense of audience exhaustion. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of comedy things that then turn into like then they become a plot driven,
right?
You know,
and so I think things, that
events that unwind it, and so the only funny part's the first two thirds.
Yeah, and so I think that was, you know, for me, just on a critical level, you know, it's a 2-hour movie. It's had so many targets. It ended up being for me uneven, but it's not a bad movie.
Yeah, it was just a bit uneven. Netflix, I can tell you, it's better than 90% of the stuff that's on Netflix.
Yes,
so. Go check 90, it out.
Yeah.
And you don't have to dedicate a binge watch for the next 2 weeks of it. You know, just go ahead.
But that's my point. For 90% of that Netflix stuff, it wasn't good enough to get on HBO. Do you know what I mean? So it's I have that same snobbery. Well,
and Netflix, boy, you know, when you see what it recommends, like if you watch sci-fi movie, it starts giving you things, and there are all these things that it made, and you're like, who's watching this movie about?
Who's got the money to make
really
some of these
just
shows?
Turn on Netflix and be like, I'm just going to watch whatever it offers to me. You know, it's like channel surfing in a new way, where you're like, fine, I'll watch that horrible movie, but a lot of it is just like, wow, somebody's actually affirmative going, they're ever cranking out this stuff. And of course, you know, you don't have the same visibility into costs and, you know, how many people actually watch it and all that stuff. But
TV goes through this cycle. TV's gone through these cycles. It's like they used to be like Cinemax would have all these shows that would only appear on Cinemax.
Yeah,
and then there's and then there's like, you know, people make jokes about Lifetime movies where it seems to employ this segment of actors and actresses and writers that keep turning out variants of the same thing. Crazy Killer Next Door, or you know, romantic comedy set at Christmas. And we all like make jokes about the Lifetime movie. Well, I hate to say this. Netflix TV, it's got a whole subculture of, you know, I'll be watching something and I'm looking at the cast and I'll have to type in the person's name and it'll be like, yes, appearances on General Hospital. But these things just get churned out. It's fascinating to me. It does, yeah. So again, what I'm saying is none of these brands anymore, all these brands like to say they represent quality, but they don't. The best of Netflix is the best of Netflix, but that doesn't mean everything on Netflix is any good.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay.
That's my only point. Because again, it's on Netflix. Yeah. Do we want to continue with TV and slip into death?
Well, so no. Well, what I wanted to talk about was another. Well, it's a segue, but my
Do your segue then.
For this
do your segue.
So in the world of,
because I have a segue to link our two deaths anyway. Sorry.
That's after this whole topic.
Okay.
In the genre of streaming media imitating or connecting into things that we have cautioned the world about before on the podcast, the Book of Boba Fett. It's also a tie-in for being Star Wars, and I occasionally drag you into Star Wars conversations.
Sure, go for
it. Book of Boba Fett is on Disney Plus. It's on up there, I forget, fourth or fifth episode. You know, they release these things each week, so that thus far, uneven in its production.
I have heard
value
that
relative to the Mandalorians, but I have not watched enough to say for sure yet, and that's not the point. But the main point was I was watching, can't remember, it was the first or second episode. And they're in Tatooine again, because apparently that's the only planet available for people in the Star Wars universe, despite the fact that it's a whole galaxy.
Yes, but it's, far away.
That's really like not even a nice planet. And walking down the street but amongst the buildings are a set of robots. It's actually kids who are sort of herding some robots, some droids, as they would say in the Star Wars thing. And I realized they were the U.S. robotics dogs, the robotic dogs that we have talked about and linked to before, which is doesn't look like a dog. It's not like, but it's got four legs. It looks like a robot, in other words, but it walks around and reminds people of dogs. So they always call it a robotic dog. It doesn't really have a head or anything like that. It's just the theory was it could carry stuff and it could get across a lot of terrain because it has legs that operate like a dog's legs and walks around. And you remember, like we'd show we talked about the video where people would kick it and it has all the balance gyroscope so that it won't fall over.
Won't fall over. Like
it'll move its legs around in a way that an actual animal would if you kicked it in the side. Well, four of these things are walking down
not
the street.
Not that either one of us go around kicking animals. I don't want to say that.
I mean,
now,
we haven't had the opportunity. We might if we did. But this was on the video version. But four or five of them are walking down the street in the show with like a little bit of different decorations on their bodies. Again, they don't look like dogs. They don't look like anything. They've been anthropomorphized a little bit. It looks like they have little wings or ears or something like that. And in fact, not that the kid kicked them, but the kids sort of like in herding them pushed them and they rebalanced themselves.
Oh,
you know, and so like they're showing the features. And so again, I mean, first interesting thing is here we are where it's connecting into things that we have spoken about on the podcast before. But the other part is now at this point, what's essentially telling us is that certain types of robotics are not only caught up with, but are arguably ahead of the Star Wars robotics, you know, because R2-D2 and C-3PO are not efficient moving vehicle, like C-3PO's, you know, classic robot shuffling its feet around. R2-D2's got these wheels.
The wheels like, from Office Depot.
Yeah, like so in theory, it shouldn't be able to go up any steps, although they've, you know, they now it's got a rocket in it, so it can jump around. Like they cheat that some of that stuff. But you've got actual robots that have better technology now. They don't have, like, intelligent brains in them. They're just carrying things around. So, that's one sort of interesting aspect. But the other was, I guess, in some segment of Star Wars world, there was a objection to that because it was a real world robot brought into the Star Wars world, you know, and it's the immersive experience of being in Star Wars is supposed to be there are Star Wars robots and Star Wars types of things. And by bringing something from the real world, it's like as if they brought a car in, you know, if you had a car driving around with tires and stuff. Well, yeah. You wouldn't do that because obviously in the Star Wars universe, they don't drive Fords or Teslas or anything like that. So you wouldn't have them in the show. They don't even have, you know, animals that are the same as our animals. They do have people who are clearly like people, but so this was like a cheap, but I was like, I don't, you know, that's fine. You know, it's, they could have covered up the equipment more. It's not like, you know, the BB-8 robot was a real robot that they had, unlike R2-D2, which had a little person in it, you know, controlling the thing. And C-3PO had a person, an actor in it, you know, moving it around. But like in more recent things, they've been like, well, shoot, we can make these things electronically. And why is that so wrong? But I don't know. I liked it. I thought it was
funny. You know, it's interesting because I'm now trying to think.
I'm not as big a purist.
I'm trying to think of other moments within. And I'm going to put a boot into Star Trek momentarily. I'm trying to think of other moments now across the whole breadth and width of Star Wars that clearly something, I don't know, I feel a little bit like, it's an unfair criticism and it's slightly moronic, but it's also actually not consistent with itself because there's been loads of other stuff in Star Wars that's shown up in the worst of the Star, I'm a big Star Trek Next Generation guy, and I've said that before.
Yeah.
Like the Kirk Star Trek, they're great, the first one, but I'm not interested in any of that anymore. But, you know, we've talked on this show about, you know, Picard and all those guys. They made about 5 movies of their own, and the last one, which had a young Tom Hardy in it, is called Star Trek Nemesis, and it got panned, and it made about $7, and it just sort of put an end to Next Generation.
Yeah.
There is a scene on that where Picard and Worf, somewhat Data, go down to a planet, and then they're driving around in the desert in what looks like a desert dune buggy. Like with big knobbly tires and, you know, a big brace and a roll cage and everything. And I remember when I first watched it, I'm like, yeah, that's great. But it doesn't feel like Star Trek. Do you know what I mean? Like if you, and this is this interesting sort of, you're right. When you start sort of putting stuff in there that is clearly of a different, that is clearly of now, I can understand some people getting bent out of shape. But, you know, I don't know. It seems a bit silly. I mean, and to be fair,
at least in the Star Trek case, you know, the Star Trek is supposed to be an evolution of an Earth society. And so you wouldn't be totally out of. I mean, we certainly have like some old things like, you know, the antiques that come showing up, a motorcycle or something like that shows up in the show. And like when they do in the holodeck, it would be things from the past. And so it'd be some connection. But, you know, in the Star Wars world, it's
like I'm going to say this, though, in Rogue One, it's the actor Alan Tudyk. He plays the robot, you know, the robot in Rogue One. Yeah. And that robot looks to me like what Boston Dynamics and all these people would be making. It looks just like a human variant of how these robot animals are designed. And what I mean by that is, you know, there's no outer casing, so you can see the joints. The joints are all clearly ball and socket. They don't have muscles, so everything is thinner, but it looks strong because it's made out of things. I didn't hear anyone getting bent out of shape about that robot.
No, well, because it's an actual robot. They had seen it. That's why I say it's like...
It's inconsistency from these Star Wars fans.
If the dog robots end up at some point in our life where we all have them, you know, like we all have, like, you know, if you were going to go camping or you're going on a hike, you'd have a dog robot that looked just like that. I could see how at that point it would seem really weird, just like it would be weird if there were cars in it. But that's not where we are now. It's like not a bunch of people are seeing the thing. You know, and so they've dressed enough and it's interesting enough. But
so for the second time, let me ask you the very trite question. Is the Boba Fett TV series any good?
I don't know yet. Because
oh, you've not been watching it.
Two or three episodes. I've been watching some, but I'm like behind. I'm not trying to keep, like Mandalorian, we sat down and we watched each episode right when it was coming out, or, you know, the day or two, or if ever it came out, but we haven't been keeping up with this one enough. I'm ambivalent. And then it happened to be, I started watching it around the time the third episode was out, but I haven't watched the third episode. And like when I went looking at something on the internet, it was like people just saying the third episode was just stunningly bad. And I can't tell if that's just because the third episode happened to be the one that came out around that time. And so if I had tuned in a week earlier, it would have said the second episode was bad, or if it's in fact because this third episode is really going to be really bad and I haven't seen it yet. So,
okay. All right.
But, you know, this will seem like a non sequitur, but this is what we do. Succession, tying in Succession and movies. I was having a discussion with the other member of the household, and I don't know if you've ever seen this on the internet where people talk about, when they're talking about a movie or a show, it's sort of like an idle thought of, in that world, does this other thing in our real world exist?
Ooh, okay.
You know, like think about an easy version is like, okay, you do a movie with the president, and like you might have the current contemporaneous president, like in the Don't Look Up is Meryl Streep. In that world, you kind of assume that Richard Nixon was a president and John F. Kennedy was a president in the past, even though it's obviously fictional now, but they live in an environment where something exists. Or like in a media property, like does the Sopranos, we know, for example, the Sopranos live in a world where the Godfather movies exist.
Yes. Right?
I mean, the Sopranos world is very literal to our thing, so maybe it's not the greatest example. But does, well, the Goodfellas is a... is a nonfiction, technically, but yeah. So, but you know, it's the kind of thing like, do these things exist? So therefore, are people colored in their information? And I came up with the theory. You've seen the movie Network, right?
Yes.
Holly Hunter and all these folks, and it's back from
broadcast news.
Broadcast
news. Network is I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore.
All right. Yeah. So broadcast news is like a news station.
That's satire.
With all these folks, and but Holly Hunter is a anchor in it. Or one of the movie. No.
William Hurt is the anchor, and Jack Nicholson is the anchor.
She's a producer. Right?
She's a producer.
Yeah. So, in Succession, and I'm not giving anything away because this was a couple of seasons ago, and it's not even like a big thing. She plays the CEO of a news organization, and it occurred to me, and it's the news organization is supposed to be like the nicer one, nicer than the main one that's in Succession, and I'm like, well, in that world, is that the same world? You know, like in the sense that she might have been a producer and she moved on from her life in the early 80s where she had this problem with broadcast news, and she kept moving up the ladder and ends up at, I think it's called Pierce News Network as the CEO. I'm like, that would be fascinating to think like, oh, is this the same character? And then as an actor, was she thinking about like, oh, what would be the background? Well, my background and my character could be the same character I played 25 years ago or whatever it was.
That's interesting.
And more than that, like 30 years
ago. It's 30 years ago.
So I was an idol. That was a non sequitur.
Okay.
You know, thought about. So I think actually maybe we'll revisit this topic at some point on some movies. I'll have to keep my eye out for another one. Like they always talk about the fact that supposedly all of the Quentin Tarantino movies are sort of supposed to be the same universe because they'll have characters that reappear tangentially in different movies.
No, I've heard that.
Disconnected kind of thing. Yeah. So.
Yeah, no, I have heard that. But then again, I think unfortunately, though, and I can't decide, because nowadays the big franchise are Marvel especially, but Star Wars are attempting to create universes.
Yeah.
Is there a certain amount of reverse engineering where you go back and you make it that way just to make it that way? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Only because you kind of can.
Is that how you watch the Star Wars and that, like the prequels that were supposed to be prior time to like the original Darth Vader and stuff? Somehow they had better technology just you know, 35 years before, because when they made the movies, it was much later and they could come out with better stuff.
Well, and again, I would imagine that's what probably. And I want to say this to our original point you were making there about the Boba Fett TV series and people getting bent out of shape. I would imagine at some moment that is the challenge. It is a challenge for a filmmaker. Or a creator, but also I can imagine there are fans who just get off put because it can't make sense.
Right.
And I know we haven't We haven't talked about the James Bond movie. We will at some moment talk the James Bond movie. Well, since that came out, there has been countless discussions about what counts and what doesn't count, because that movie ends with quite a big sort of moment that can that can retroactively change how you feel about older movies. And I think that's the challenge whenever you do anything like this. And I think especially with Star Wars, I get it. It's in quite a hard place to because you can't, you don't want to just recreate that movie. People would sit around and go, this is just like that movie. People would want to have it both ways. But then you try and put in something clearly that you can from now, 50 years, 55 years later, people then criticize that. So, it's hard.
That doesn't fit, you know.
Yeah, right.
But we took much longer on this than I expected because we were going to segue into another drone robot.
Yes, real quick. And also a dog story.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, stranded this weekend or just a couple of days ago back in Hampshire, which is a county on the south coast of England, a stranded dog was saved from rising tide after rescuers attached sausage to a drone. A team in Hampshire ties sausage to drone as last resort to rescue Millie the Jack Russell from the mudflats. So the dog had wandered out into the mudflats because it's on the south coast and clearly the tide was coming in. And the poor old dog, who is a Jack Russell Whippet, crossover, she had just decided that she wasn't moving. And obviously the tide was coming and the police and everyone, the Coast Guard.
It was a skittish dog. And so person couldn't go out there because she might just run further into the water or something.
And also they're mud flats. So it's quite treacherous to be walking across it. You can't get a boat in there. So ultimately all you can try and do is to try and encourage the dog to come out. So what they did was the rescuers had to think imaginatively, and they came up with the idea of attaching a sausage to a drone and hoping the scent of the treat would tempt Millie to safety. It worked, and Millie was reunited with her owners. I had originally thought, because again, this is a me thing. I only read the first couple of paragraphs of the article, and then I jump all the way down to the bottom. I had imagined when I'd seen the headline that they'd attached a sausage to the drone. The drone had flown out there. The dog had grabbed the sausage.
Oh, and then flew
and
it
then
back.
Been brought in like a helicopter. Well, in fact, they just waved it around, and the dog chased the sausage. The best quote in the whole article was, Chris Taylor, the chair of the Denmead drone search and rescue team, he'd said, one of the local residents on the beach where we were flying from supplied us with the sausages. I think they were from Aldi. The woman cooked them up for us, and we attached them with string.
The dog likes cooked sausage.
Yes. So it wasn't a hot dog. It was actually a proper pork sausage, which you probably have to cook all the way through. Otherwise, the dog will get a tapeworm or whatever. So they had to cook them up, then attach them to the drone.
Just a lure.
Yeah, they flew the drone out there. The dog was like, oh, and then the dog came back. I must have basically followed the drone back to safe land, like off the mudflats. Because Millie was hungry, it worked luring her away from the danger to higher ground, which wasn't underwater. We certainly would consider using sausages again. Every dog and search operation is going to be different, but if we were ever in a similar situation again, we would employ the same methods to lure the dog. It doesn't say if they actually tossed the sausage to the dog when she gets back.
Yeah, I hope so. That'd be rude.
According to her owner, Millie really likes food, and she'll eat anything you give her. Raw carrots, cucumber. But she much prefers sausages. Meat is her favorite food, so dangling a sausage was probably the best thing they could lure her with. So there you go. Big drone rescue.
I don't have the article up, but I remember thinking one of the things was towards the end, they sort of talked about like, oh, maybe this is like a new line of stuff we could do. Like that guy with the drone rescue was, it seemed like this had opened a door to him to like other possibilities of what to do that, oh, I could make a living doing this, you know, whatever it was.
There'll be, I'm trying to think now of the like old movies from the 50s where the fire brigade are called out to rescue the cat in the tree. Maybe now You can just have drones do all of this.
In fact, I'm trying to find it here. You may see me looking at my phone here, but behind my, I can't find it. There was an Instagram account that I had recommended to me, you know, like with the whole thing, where it was like, it appeared that the guy's entire job was rescuing cats from trees. Like he was like a serious arborist car. Like he would go all the hard hat. Like he's not like just going up like special ladders and all that. Way up.
Yeah.
And I forget what area in the country he was in, but it was like, he must get called, like he would have to drive hours to different places where somebody's cat got up like a 100-foot-high tree and they're trying to rescue the cat, you know. And so he'd get there and the cats would have been up in the tree for like 3 days.
Yeah.
And then he'd go up there and rescue them. So like, I mean, there's a line of business for you. I mean, what do you charge when you do that? Time and materials.
I mean, I've got a segue.
I had another thing about the dog. Do you think they, oh, you know what? The other thing, the article was really had no video. Like who? How could this have been going on? And somebody wasn't filming a video, right?
That did surprise me. They had time to run to Aldi, have someone cook sausages. I cannot believe
somebody pick up their phone.
Yeah, I can't believe there's no phone coverage or anything. Of look at the great committee. Maybe people felt it wasn't going to work, and
yeah, maybe the 2 points putting them together. Maybe it's a scam. Maybe the guy was trying to open a new line for the rescue business. He did not actually rescue you, but he did. He colluded with some folks of like, let's tell a story to the local news that you know the sausage saved the dog. So this way, I can make a couple of bucks on things. And you know, we can't do a video if we don't actually do it.
I'm actually clicking on the website. They have
We can tell because we can hear the music.
Yeah, they actually have sort of a video, but it's not really video. It's just a series of still pictures. The only video is a video. Oh, no, they have a video from the drone. I will link the article.
Oh, that's true. Good point.
They are showing. I'm sorry. This is my own fault for not researching these things. So the drone is dangling down what looks like at least a 15.
Well, I was going to ask, does it mean the sausage was on a string or was the sausage like strapped to an arm?
The sausage was on a string. And to be fair, the dog didn't, I hate to use a cliche, the dog did not bite hook, line, and sinker. When the sausage was first dangled, the dog sort of moved. Then it kind of looked around and wasn't sure. And they had to keep sort of hovering the drone, so the sausage would sort of wave within the dog's line of sight. So we will link the article on the blog. Click on the link. You will see what it actually looked like.
Last couple of points.
Yeah. I guess my segue is talking of cooked meats.
Right.
We're going to finish off. Wow, because we actually burned through an hour pretty quickly.
Yeah, we did. We've gone through a lot. So only one of our obituaries that was planned, or unless we decide like two sentences on the other one.
I'm just going to do two sentences on the other one because they're both. One actually is a cooked meat, and I'm sure you know the two of them ate plenty of cooked meat in their time. We actually had some other people die a couple of weeks ago, but hey, life moves on. The first guy, and I never realized this week, comedian Louis Anderson.
Or as nasty as a spitball, meet the Cottrell family. You're about to see these two teams battle it out for $10,000 in cash, because it's time to play the Family Feud.
He used to do the daytime Family Feud
now,
or something like that.
Now, here's the star of our show.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Wake up the kids and untie grandma. Let's play the feud.
Yeah.
The Rogers family.
Louis Anderson, stand-up comedian, portly gentleman, very big, I think, in the 80s. Probably the guy that people would get confused with John Candy because physically they were the same. Eddie Murphy said he was the funniest white guy I ever knew. And he had him in Coming to America. I think he plays someone in like a fast food restaurant, I think, in Coming to America. Yeah. He's also in a number of foods. But he was a stand-up comedian. And I didn't notice. And I knew that he'd been a host of Family Feud. I didn't realize he was the first host after Richard Dawson, who was like the original host.
Okay.
Richard Dawson, when Family Feud first showed up at the end of the 60s and 70s, Richard Dawson, who had been an actor who was on Hogan's Heroes, he was the first host of Family Feud. And then it went off the air. And then when it came back in the late 80s, early 90s, Louis Anderson was the host. And but he was also, I've seen clips of his act and stuff. Some of the most recent work he did was he worked with, I can see his face. And what's his name from The Hangover?
Yeah, Galifianakis. Was there Galifianakis? The show is called Baskets, and he plays a woman.
Yeah.
And not a woman like he's playing him from a cross-dressing or something like that. Just plays straight as a woman. When Zach Galifianakis and Louis C.K., he doesn't get mentioned more, but they put together that show.
Louis Anderson, no relation.
They decided, like, Louis Anderson, they were like, oh, we want to get him, and we think he'd be great as a sort of a Midwestern mom type. Yeah. And so he just played it that way. And apparently, I think he got an Emmy for one of that.
Yeah,
for that one year, and he also got some Emmys for some of his voice work.
Yes, and he did have that distinctive voice that you just heard a bit of there. Like you'd hear that voice,
Did you read any of his obituaries? I mean, he had a really horrible, dark, like, past, like, in his family.
Yes.
Like, a bunch of kids, and I forget all the hardships and stuff like that. And so, like, apparently, he started off as somehow he was going to be a child. Not a psychologist, but like a social worker or something like that, and somehow bust into the comedy realm and then goes from there. And apparently in the early days, he had some much darker comedy and found that he sold better as more of a family friendly comedian. I read something where he was getting interviewed by somebody on a podcast and explained what one of his jokes was when he was a dark comedian. And I was like, oh, that's pretty dark. It was like killing your family kind of dark. Well, but he took a different pivot.
It is interesting. Because obviously we're not going to talk about him, but Bob Saget died recently, and for a vast number of people, Bob Saget is quite a vanilla TV sitcom character type, and yet if you look at some of his acts, you know, he's as raunchy and as cutting as any of them. So it's interesting, you know, a lot of these comedians, dual lives is the wrong word, but I think sometimes they're able. You know, they are able, either within the moment or across their careers, to sort of really, I think that's the real skill, is that you can have, you can reset your comedy to the audience without losing your authenticity. Do you know what I mean? It's like, you know, it's funny, and I only mentioned him because I saw him the other day on the movie with Charlize Theron, Patton Oswalt. And I was talking to my stepdaughter about it because she's a big fan of some modern stand-up people like John Mulaney and these kind of people. And, you know, Patton Oswalt is one of those guys who can, you know, he can get pretty tough and cutting, but he's also created his comedy in such a way that he's just very funny. And Louis Anderson is one of those guys. Whereas I think if you think to, especially from the 80s, you know, some of his peers like Bobcat Goldthwait or Sam Kinison, they had quite narrow lanes. Bobcat Goldthwait just involved a lot of like screeching and wailing. Sam Kinison's comedy was quite, at times, quite misogynistic and angry and whatever. You know, Louis Anderson was one of those guys across his career that was able to, you know, morph is the wrong word, but he could do the whole thing. And like I say, you know, from when I read one of his obits, it was the Eddie Murphy quote that stood out to me. Like, yeah, it's the funniest. This guy's hilarious. And there's nothing more for me when what comedians say of other comedians, for me, is like the most. Actors talking about other actors is not a big deal. But when comedians who know how hard it is to construct routines, when they say it about someone else, that's when you go, no, that dude really is funny.
Yeah.
So anyway, he passed away, but then also passed away Meatloaf.
Meatloaf. Born Marvin something, Marvin Lee Adey, but actual name was changed to Meatloaf, apparently another portly fella, and that was originally, it's not known for sure, but was an insult, you know, at him by his high school friends. Born in Dallas, Texas, so, although he's some disputed year, apparently 74 is the generally thought age, but at times he had a 4 year younger age, they said. I'm kind of curious. I mean, I'm probably, most of our listeners know who Meatloaf is.
Dude, should I play something? Because I don't.
Play the original big song, the first one I mentioned to you.
Anything?
Which this would be
Paradise
from
by Dashboard, or
exactly
the other one?
Right.
This one.
Paradise by Dashboard.
Okay, hold on. There's my technology. Hold on, I'm doing the technological. Normally, my partner handles the stuff.
So. You might want to just turn it down because we'll just talk over, because it's, well, how long is it? 9 minutes, I think.
Yes. It happened only yesterday.
So he, this was part of his first album, Bat Out of Hell, and was co-written with a guy whose name is going to escape me at the moment, Steinem or something like that. And
no, he's Steinman.
Away like, no, 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 he's not. That's a different person. That's oh. It's Steinman, and Steinman's the guy who was oh. his co-writer, and like they kind of came and went in their each other's lives for a while, and but all his big successes are Steinman written or Steinman co-written type of stuff, and so Paradise But a Dashboard Light is this like epic long song about like teenage angst and hooking up. Paradise But a Dashboard Light is a song like where they're hooking up in the car. Basically.
Yeah.
And it's got a Phil Rizzuto segment, like halfway through it, a spoken word segment where Phil Rizzuto's talking about rounding the bases.
Holy cow.
Like, well, it's a whole long thing. He's like, he's going for second base. He's going for third base and the whole bit. And it's all very, what's weird is...
It all sounds like the Rocky Horror Picture Show to me.
And that's what he's from.
Yes, yes.
You know, he was like the first of the actors. He did a lot of Broadway stuff. And this is the thing about, like, I don't own any Meatloaf albums, but I've heard these songs 8 million times. And it's always struck me that it was all really, like, as they'd say, theater kids stuff. Like, it's this weird sort of, it's rock, but it's campy, and it's not like, it doesn't, I don't know, for me, and I'm not even necessarily opposed to it, but it didn't resonate with me because it didn't seem very, like, sincere. It didn't seem, it was, like, all set up. And I just read something recently, and I'm going to flub this, but apparently in some interviews, the guy Steinman or whatever his name was, they basically conceded, Todd Rundgren was helping do the production on one of these albums. There's a whole bunch of, like, famous people on a lot of these
Todd Rundgren, Werewolves of Lundgren.
Yeah. Is that right? He wrote that?
Oh, Werewolves of London.
Well, Warren Zevon.
Is that Todd Rundgren?
Right?
No. Oh, no. Is that Warren Zevon? Oh, okay.
Okay.
Sorry. So anyway, I'll take that back.
So apparently, this was like, he claims that it was like making fun of Bruce Springsteen. That, like, the album, it's like the stuff was written in such a way, it was this super duper sort of rock thing, but it was almost like a Bruce Springsteen satire. Or, like, saying you can kind of just do this stuff and, look, I'm going to make a bunch of money by creating these big songs, these epic sort of rock songs that, like, are their versions of it.
It is interesting.
Could be, like, as we talked about, like, retconning, you know, like, the story.
But you said this, that you know, you didn't own the album, but you'd heard the song, you know, 8 million times. I felt like when I was growing up, it was one of those albums that you didn't have, but everyone knew someone who had Bat Out of Hell.
Right. And his album, like, so there's, we'll talk about it, but there are three different Bat Out of Hell albums. He'd done, like, 15 right. or but some my, albums, but three of them are Bat Out of Hell. They've sold, I forget.
It's huge.
What the heck is it? 300 is crazy. Sold over 100 million records worldwide. The Bat Out of Hell originally was 44 million worldwide itself. It's the fourth best selling album in history, right? Like, so, like, you people you knew owned it, right? Like, whether you think so or not, you know, 44 million albums is a lot of albums.
So here's the interesting thing. I remember the first time I heard it, and someone had the album, and you looked at the cover, and it's this very stylized. I remember it's like a chopper motorbike. Yeah. And I remember
it looks like something you'd paint on the back of a
right.
or on the side of a custom van. It's like this sort of, like, it's literally a motorcycle coming out of the depths of hell and devils and things like that. But it doesn't, like, that's why it's funny that it's very theatrical. It could have been a metal album.
I was just about to say, I didn't know anything about what you just told me, that it was almost intentionally campy. But I remember when I first heard it and I saw the album cover, I remember saying to people, I felt like this was part of something else that I just didn't know about. And so there is something about it where it does, most definitely, it doesn't, and intentionally, it's not trying to just stand on its own as a piece of music. And I know off the cuff, I'm probably trying to have a more in-depth critical discussion about something, so I apologize if my thoughts are all over the place, but I did, until you just told me what you just told me, now it makes perfect sense, because it always felt like it was something else. Do you know what I mean? Because there was something about the whole act that it wasn't, you know, AC/DC, or and I'm just shouting out sort of music from that time, or Status Quo, or you know, it wasn't any of those things. It did feel at the time it was something like, well, this is a bit different. And the guy was called Meatloaf, and just and only
like
now
a lot of it's a weird mishmash of like elements pulled around. Like the cover, it looks like a metal album, and this sounds like a Bruce Springsteen thing. And the guy is this big fat guy, and he was in the movie version of Rocky Horror Picture Show in 75. So 2 years before this first album comes out, when he's already 30 years old, right? Like it's as if like somebody was like, "Hey, man, I'm really into theater, you know. I could probably make an album. I could probably make a bunch of songs. I don't have to act. It's essentially the songs are going to be the acting, and it connects with this guy who does this stuff. And it's Jim. I found his name. Jim Steinman was the other guy who helped do all these things. And
but to be fair, I know this is now an unfair sort of you know comparison. It's not like Weird Al Yankovic.
No.
Right, which is so clearly. What I hate to say is so clearly mimicking or in a bit of a piss take and whatever, and it's just lyrics and it's the original tunes and you kind of know what you're getting into. Meatloaf does work on a couple of different levels. Yeah, and it's still, you know, considering its era, I mean, these songs don't get that many plays. Again, if the music itself doesn't hold water. Do you know what I'm trying to make here? Yeah. I think that's what that's kind of the genius in it a little bit. Is it still, it stands on its own as solid music. And it's not my thing, but it is for a whole load of people. And it has this incredible afterlife. I said to you before the show in the virtual blue room, I said to you that or green room, I said to virtual green room. Virtual blue room sounds like, I don't know, champagne or something. I said to you that, they turned it into a stage musical. That ran on.
Well, so they took the damn. So like the funny thing is, so he does this, obviously a big success, kind of fades off. I think he eventually goes broke. He certainly has some drug and alcohol problems. And then his major new reappearance is in 1993 with Bat Outta Hell 2, which is not. By the way, it's not the next album after this. It's basically because he reconnects with Jim Steinman. And so now they're going to like, well, you know, we'll just rename it. Because he goes, Bat Outta Hell, there's songs Dead Ringer, Midnight in the Lost and Found, Bad Attitude, Blind Before I Stop. And then finally comes back to Bat Outta Hell 2. And that's in 93. And in fact, really gets a lot of MTV. And there's where the next song comes up here, which we won't spend much time on.
Well, just let it play and then we can get out.
Yeah, exactly. So the song here is, I would do anything for love, parentheses, but I won't do that. Right. What? And so there was a lot of jokes and like people will probably recognize it, but there's a lot of jokes on Twitter. It's like, well, now we're never going to know what that was.
Well, obviously you can only hear the music, but you mentioned MTV, you know, before the tune played, this is a very cinematic video with guys on bikes and helicopters. And it reeks of MTV early 90s production value.
Yep. And then, so that's 93. He does two more albums. And then there's Bat Outta Hell 3, The Monster Is Loose. You know, each of these has a similar sort of cover. And Bat Outta Hell Loose is in 2006. So now we're a full 30 years after the first of those. And I don't think there was any big song out of this, but, you know, those are his three biggest selling albums in total. And you could turn it up, and that's the main thing, right?
Yeah. But I'll never forget the way you feel right now. Oh, no. And the video is, you know, he's all in makeup and clearly dressed as some sort of, you know, warlock type character. Like, what I'm saying, it's not just dude singing, right?
Now, a couple other little tidbits. So apparently, like, I forget which opera person, you know, every now and then these rock people get called upon to do something operatic. Like, remember Aretha Franklin had to fill in for somebody and, like, killed it. Apparently, I don't know if it was Pavarotti or somebody else, he basically did a duet and held his own.
Oh, like, really?
He had a big enough voice. And so, like, that was, like, the big deal there. He is, of course, he's also in Fight Club, Robert.
Movie
is Robert Paulson, where he plays, like, a former steroids guy. He's got a lot of body problems as a rat, but a big fat guy, and then he gets killed.
He meets him in rehab.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I mean, just an interesting character. Oh, and oh, of course, the kicker is that his biggest fame in most recent years was he was on Celebrity Apprentice. There's a, you know, you can find the YouTube video of him blowing up at Gary Busey because Gary Busey had bought all the paints for some project they were doing for Donald Trump.
He also found that.
He also then, by the way, became a big Trumpie and counts, you know, he said like Ivanka Trump is one of his closest friends and he's an anti-vaxxer. So reasonably decent chance that his passing at age 74, mind you, comorbidities there. So it's but could have been, you know, COVID related.
Oh, boom.
I don't think they said yet for sure. But in any event, he was off on a fringe that I'm not too fond of.
All right. Yeah. Oh, interesting. So anyway, yeah, he passed away. So some big names, metaphorically and literally, leaving us.
As we joked, because we had planned to talk about Sidney Poitier. Somehow Sidney Poitier got bumped by Louis Anderson and
this guy.
Meatloaf dying. So
yeah, I feel a bit bad.
Goes to show you the modern society. Maybe we'll come back to it. You know, we could actually do a whole, you know, we've oftentimes doing, well, not often, we occasionally have done stuff that kind of focus on a particular actor. I haven't seen enough Sidney Poitier albums to say, but that would be an interesting one to talk.
Yeah, well, I'd actually
probably had fewer jokes.
I pulled clips from In the Heat of the Night and To Sir With Love, and also his sort of 80s revival all the way through to Sneakers with Robert Redford.
Yeah,
great movie.
That one I know.
Yes, yeah. And Dan Aykroyd, who probably knew Louis Anderson and River Phoenix.
6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon.
I do feel like Sneakers is one of those movies that doesn't get enough play and people don't remember, but it's probably got like 1,000 trivia questions hidden through it.
That would be a lot of trivia connections. But that's the movie that nowadays would probably get a 50% on Rotten Tomatoes because it's not far enough off of being artsy. What's the Watergate movie with Redford?
All the President's Men.
All the President's Men. It's
Ben
like, it's not
Kingsley
that. It's a little bit too. It's a drama, but it's a little too light, you know. And they'd probably be like, "Oh, no, this isn't really worth it. The time, you know."
And it's not of the mid '90s caper movies.
Mm-hmm.
The caper itself is not.
There's no real serious action.
Yeah, interesting old thing. So anyway, there you go. Maybe we'll do some Sidney Poitier maybe next time at least if nothing else, because it is a very interesting career and also just everything about who he was. So yeah, let me turn. I'll turn him back up when we get out. But this has been the Atlantic Voice Podcast. I'm Zeff,
and I'm Eric. Take care.
Just enjoyed Eric and Zeff on the Atlantic Voice podcast. Follow us on Twitter at @Atlantic_voice. You can find the show at libsyn.com, iTunes, and of course at atlanticvoice.net. Email us at atlanticvoice@gmail.com. And now on YouTube, search for the Atlantic Voice. The Atlantic Voice, 3,000 miles of opinion.